This talk is brought to you by FOCUS, the Fellowship of Catholic University Students. Defending Life by Francis Beckwith.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here. My name's Francis Beckwith. I'm a professor at Baylor University, which is about 120 miles from here. Anybody from Baylor, by the way, just out of curiosity? Oh, good. Good. It's great to have some Baylor folks here. We don't actually have a FOCUS group at Baylor, partly because we're Baptist. But I'm Catholic, so you might have heard about that. It's great to be here. This afternoon I'm going to talk about defending life and how to respond to the sorts of arguments that you may hear on your college campus. Some of you go to big state universities, other small liberal arts colleges, other the Catholic colleges. None of that, by the way, means that you aren't going to hear arguments defending abortion rights. And what I want to offer you this afternoon is a way to deal with those arguments in a way that's intelligent and winsome, and at the same time defends the pro-life position in a way that is fair and charitable to those with whom you disagree. I mean, one of the things we have to remember, those of us who are pro-life and we're defending our point of view, we have to remember that the folks we're talking with are, in fact, human beings, also made in the image of God, who are entitled to dignity and respect. So what I want to do this afternoon is kind of go over how to deal with some of these arguments. I'm going to share a few stories of my own, from my own experience of debates I've been in, and tell you a few things about material that's been coming out over the past couple of years defending the abortion rights position that has become more sophisticated. And hopefully it'll be helpful, and I'll open the floor for about 15, 20 minutes of questions towards the end. So, welcome. If you're interested in reading more, I have a website, francisbeckwith.com, in which I have a number of my articles arguing for the pro-life position that you can download. And I also have a new book that just came out with Cambridge University Press called Defending Life, which you can get through Amazon.com. And I check every day to see how many I'm selling. So that's really, you know, authors, you know, they won't admit that, but it's absolutely, you know, this happened a couple of weeks ago. I checked and my book shot up to like the top 1,000. I thought, what happened? You know, so I immediately do a Google search, and apparently Father Joseph Kavanaugh, University of St. Louis University, reviewed the book for America and gave it a really nice review. And, of course, that means that it went up in Amazon. So if any of you would be willing to write a review, I'd be more than grateful. In order to understand, when we talk about the pro-life position, let me define a few things, and then I'll get into some more detailed arguments. One of the problems that I think we have in our contemporary culture today is that when we talk about being pro-life, or when we talk about defending any moral position, sometimes people often confuse a moral claim with a preference claim. Now, what do I mean by that? A preference claim is something like this. I like vanilla ice cream better than chocolate ice cream. That's a preference claim. And it's weird to tell people they're wrong about those things, right? You know, if you say, I like vanilla ice cream, and somebody says, no, you don't. You're sort of an expert in what you already, that you know to be true about yourself. Now, it could be that eating vanilla ice cream could be, in some sense, immoral, but you know you like it. I remember when I first got married, my wife's here, so we can't talk about her. I usually say that if I'm on television, I talk about the Amish because I know they're not watching. But my wife asked, when we first got married, she'd ask questions like, why do you like this? And I'd say, I just like it. You know, like some food, like strawberries with whipped cream. Why do you like it? I don't know. I just do. I mean, there's something about preference claims that are sort of fundamental. You can't really give any reasons other than the fact that you happen to like them. Moral claims are different. Moral claims are claims about what you ought or ought not to do. So, for example, if I say killing persons without justification is wrong, it doesn't do any good for somebody to say, yes, but I think I enjoy killing persons without justification. That is to say, responding to a normative claim by announcing your preference doesn't count against the normative claim. In the abortion debate, you often hear this. I remember a couple of years ago, was driving around and I saw this bumper sticker said, "Don't like abortion, don't have one." I don't know if you've ever seen that bumper sticker. You may have heard people use it as a little quip on a talk show or something like that. And I thought to myself, that's like saying, don't like spousal abuse, don't beat one. I mean, imagine if somebody had said that on a bumper sticker, don't like spousal abuse, don't beat one. You would immediately recognize that they truly did not understand what makes spousal abuse wrong. What makes it wrong is that it is wrong no matter whether you enjoy it or not. That is to say, your enjoyment of it is not relevant to assessing whether it's good or bad. Now, that doesn't make the pro-life position correct. But what we have to do is to understand what it means when we make the claim that abortion is wrong. We're making the claim that it is not merely wrong in terms that I don't prefer it, but that it is intrinsically wrong. And for something to be intrinsically wrong, it means that, in fact, your liking or disliking it's not relevant. And you hear this quite often in the public square. I remember years ago, I don't know if any of you guys remember the Phil Donahue show. Some of you may have heard of it. It was sort of a precursor to Jerry Springer. Jerry Springer's like a traffic accident. You know you shouldn't slow down and watch, but sometimes you do. The old Phil Donahue show, there was a dentist in San Antonio, Texas, who came home one afternoon and found his kids watching Phil Donahue, and he didn't like what was on there, so he sent letters to advertisers, and they wound up pulling their ads from the Donahue show. So Donahue brought his show down to San Antonio for a special week of episodes and invited the dentist to be a guest. Well, the dentist didn't show up, but a number of people who agreed with his point of view showed up. And one of them, actually, I believe it was the Archbishop of San Antonio, was one of the guests. I'm not sure, but I know there was a Catholic prelate of some sort there. There was an encounter at one of the episodes that really exemplifies this problem that I'm conveying to you this afternoon. There was a young lady in the audience who was very upset about what this dentist had done in terms of getting ads pulled. And her argument was, well, if you don't like the Donahue show, you don't have to watch it. And the Archbishop responds by saying, well, it's not a matter of the dentist not wanting to watch what he doesn't like or his kids not watching it. The problem is that he's troubled that his neighbor's kids may watch it and they may grow up to date his kids. That is to say, his argument is a public good argument. It isn't just he doesn't like it. It's that it harms people in some way. It gives them a distorted or deformed view of what it means to be a human being. That's the issue. Now, of course, the question of what you should do in terms of public policy is a different question. But the first thing we have to understand is when people make moral arguments, what exactly they're saying. They are not announcing to you what they agree or disagree with. Okay, now let's talk about more specifically the abortion debate. The issue in abortion is this. Who and who is not a member of the human community? That ultimately is the question. And most of the ways in which people argue about the issue in public either assume an answer to that question without arguing for it or simply ignore the question. So let me give you a couple of illustrations of how I've dealt with this in a few debates I've been in. Several years ago, it's been how many years now? 18 years. I must have been 12 when I had this debate. No, I was a professor at UNLV, University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Anyone here from UNLV, just out of curiosity? I know they actually have a Thomas Aquinas Institute there on campus, a Catholic center. Just curious to see if anyone is from there. I was a professor at UNLV, and I debated a social work professor on the issue of abortion. And there was a question in the audience from one of the... one of the people in the audience who was wearing clearly pro-choice. She was wearing all the garb and buttons and T-shirt and all that stuff. And she walked up to the microphone and she said, "Why don't pro-lifers adopt the children they don't want aborted?" And, of course, the implication in the question was that, in fact, pro-lifers do not, in fact, engage in works of mercy. Now, which is actually empirically false, by the way. pro-lifers, in fact, do a lot of things outside of protesting against abortion and writing letters and passing legislation. Pro-lifers, in fact, do a lot more than they're given credit for. But let's just set aside that empirical falsehood and deal with the question. So what I did is, when she asked me that question, I said, well, imagine if my wife and I had three children, ages 10, 6, and 4, and I told you that we were going to kill them if you weren't willing to adopt them by midnight. If you declined to adopt them by midnight, would that mean that we were justified in killing them? No. Why not? Well, they're people. Oh, so the issue in abortion is whether the unborn are people, not whether the pro-lifers are willing to adopt them. That is to say, the issue is the nature of the unborn. That's what's doing the work. Right? My good friend Greg Kokel uses this illustration. He says, if somebody has, let's say a father has his back turned to his daughter, and she walks up to him and says, "Daddy, can I kill it?" What's the first question he's going to ask? What is it? Right? Because it makes a difference whether it's a cockroach or her little brother. Right? In other words, that's what's doing the work. Okay, so keep that in mind. When it comes to the issue of abortion, the nature of the unborn is ultimately doing the work. And a couple more examples. Several years ago, when my wife was working as a manager of the Las Vegas Athletic Club, it was 1989, and there was a member of the club that had her sign a petition that was going to put Roe v. Wade on the books of Nevada law as a statute, because at that time it looked like Roe v. Wade was going to probably be overturned by the Supreme Court. It turned out that didn't happen, and so there were a lot of states where pro-abortion advocates were trying to get the something like Roe v. Wade as a statute, so that if Roe v. Wade were overturned, the state would still preserve the right to abortion without having to go through all the court battles that they anticipated. So this member of the club told my wife, "Oh, this will put your pro-life view on the ballot." And it wasn't totally true. I came into work out, so my wife shows me the petition, and I said, "Well, this woman has lied to you. That's not what it says." And I didn't know she was like standing right here, you know. And so she said, "Are you calling me a liar?" You know, that's a rhetorical question, isn't it? You don't want to answer. You can literally answer rhetorical questions. Someone says, "Who died and made you boss?" Just say Fred, right? So she said, "Well," I said, "if you intentionally told a falsehood to someone who's entitled to the truth, that would, of course, make you a liar." But, you know, that didn't make her happy. So we got into this big discussion about abortion. And what happened is like a little crowd started to form, you know, her boyfriend was an ex-UNLV basketball player. He was like 6'8". What, Bruce Chapman, that's his name? And he was actually, I was a little nervous, to be honest with you. And he was laughing. But there was one point where she said, "Well, what about the cases of rape or incest?" Which are the most difficult cases for the pro-life position. Not because there aren't good moral arguments to defend the pro-life position, but because it puts the pro-lifer in an awkward position to have to say that the victim of something as gruesome as a rape must tolerate the development of the rapist's child in her womb. That is a very difficult emotional thing to have to defend. So there was silence. And so I responded by asking her, "If there were no cases of rape or incest, would you still be for abortion rights?" She said, "Yes." And I said, "Then why did you bring that up as an issue? It's not relevant to establishing your position." That is, her position is that abortion is permissible in all instances because it is morally benign. In other words, she doesn't need extreme cases to justify her position. It would be like saying, "Should we pull the plug on grandpa if he's in a permanently vegetative state?" People could debate that. That doesn't mean if grandpa is healthy and jumping around, you can shoot him. In other words, you can't use the extreme example to establish a more general principle. Now, the point is not to argue for those difficult cases. The point is to get back to the real issue. And the real issue is, what is the scope of the human community? Does it include the unborn? And if it does include the unborn, we have to answer the rape incest question in light of that. We don't answer the nature of the unborn in light of the difficult circumstance. So we went on and argued some more, and then eventually I worked out on the Stairmaster, which sounds like a guru that looks at you, right? The Stairmaster. Okay, so let's let me say a few other things about popular arguments. I mean, one of the women here don't get this, but the men will. The number of times I've debated this issue, I usually get the question, if you're a man, you can't get pregnant, kind of, you know. And of course, that somehow exempts me, or actually eliminates me from having any opinion on the issue of abortion. Now, there's a provocative way I responded to this, and I don't think I should use the example. Okay, I'm looking at the Stairmaster. Whoops. In the debate I had with my adversary, Professor Langston, back in 1989, that was the first thing she brought up. She said, "You're a man. What do you know about getting pregnant?" Of course, she wasn't testing my knowledge of biology. I mean, she wasn't challenging. Well, of course I know. I learned in fifth grade, you know, something like that. That would have been a funny response. "Why, you don't know, Professor Langston? You're a social work professor." So what I did, I looked at her and I said, "Professor Langston, arguments don't have penises." That was my response. And it got a gasp from the audience. My brother-in-law was the one who had, before with the debate, he said, "You know, what if she brings up the man argument?" And I said, "Well, I'll tell her she's committed the ad hominem fallacy, you know, which is what philosophers will do, you know. You've committed the ad hominem fallacy. You've attacked a person rather than an argument." And he goes, no, you can't use that. He goes, "No one will get it. You have to use something really quick." And he's the one who came up with that comeback. I said, "At the end of the day, you accept the opinion of 9 men on the issue of abortion, namely the U.S. Supreme Court. So apparently some of us do know enough about it to have an intelligent opinion, and you apparently accept that one. So it turns out you only accept the opinions of men that agree with you, but you wouldn't be the first woman to have taken that position." So in any event, there was one episode that was actually quite kind of funny. I was on the a radio show at Iowa State. Anyone here from Iowa State? I had 1993, my first book on abortion came out, called Politically Correct Death, and a number of these college radio programs, they would interview me, but they kind of set me up, you know. And after a while I got kind of accustomed to it. I'd get on the show and they'd say, "Also joining us in the studio is so-and-so from the National Organization for Women, or the ACLU, or some group that defends abortion rights." And so, this was one of those situations. They had somebody in the studio who disagreed with my views. And she, first thing she said was, "You're a man. You can't get pregnant. What do you know about, you know, how can you comment about abortion?" Now, keep in mind, I was at home on the phone, and she was in the studio. And, of course, my first name is Francis, which I found out in second grade is a girl's name. So I'm sitting there and I go, and I said, "How do you know I'm a man?" She goes, "Well, you are. You have a deep voice." I said, "Well, Brenda Vaccaro has a deep voice." Some of you guys remember, I'll say B. Arthur. B. Arthur has a deep voice, one of the Golden Girls, right? Who else? I mean, who's Courtney Love? Does she have a deep voice? I don't know. That really dates me, too. I can't go any more in the present. In any event, I said, look, lots of women have deep voices. You know, she said, well, you are a man. The host called you, by the male pronoun. I said, well, he could be wrong as well. And she started getting really mad. She was saying, you're a man. And I actually felt pretty good. I'll be honest with you. I said, I admitted it. I came clean. I confessed. I said, I'm a man, and I can't help it. I was born that way. I'm a man trapped in a man's body, And so I said, wait a second. I said, look, what if you had found my book in a bookstore and you didn't know whether it was a man or a woman from the mere fact that the name Francis, although Francis with an I is male, there are some actually women who write Francis with an I who use the I rather than the E. I said, and besides, I dedicate the book to my spouse whose name is Frankie. Okay? It's true. And what if you didn't know? How would you deal with my arguments? Would the first thing that crossed your mind is, I wonder if this is a man that's written this book or a woman. That actually is the worst way to approach a text. The best way to approach a text is to say, how can I learn from this person? That is, are there arguments here worth assessing? To actually dismiss somebody's position because of who they are rather than because of what they argue for is something we call prejudice. Right? You're not defending prejudice, are you? No. So I said, look, we can go back and forth all morning and argue and call each other names. I said, or we can actually discuss the question. What do you want to do? Discuss the question. And so we went on and had a pretty good discussion from that point forward. The point is this. One of the things as pro-lifers we have to do is get people back to the question. Always back to the question. Bringing them back. Always ask yourself this question. If the unborn is a person, how does it make a difference in the argument? In other words, how does it change the pro-choice argument if we assume the unborn is a person? If it makes the argument look bad, that means that's really the issue. Let me give you one more example. When I was at UNLV, it's 1988. I had just started. Some of you weren't even born yet. 1988, I would just began teaching there, did my PhD at Fordham in New York, and wrote an op-ed piece on that time, Michael Dukakis, who was running for president against George H.W. Bush, the father of not try, not beat him, right? That's what Bill Clinton would tell you. I feel your pain. And, actually, right now, Hillary feels my pain. that's bad. So, Michael Dukakis was running for president against George H.W. Bush, and I had just read a small book by one of my favorite writers, Peter Kreft, at Boston College, who had written a book called The Unaborted Socrates, which Socrates comes back to the 20th century and debates different people on the issue of abortion. In fact, it's a wonderful book. And so I decided to write, because Dukakis was Greek, I decided to write a mock dialogue between Socrates and Michael Dukakis on the issue of abortion. It was called Socrates Meets Dukakis. It's all Greek to me. And the local paper published it, and the next week my colleague Craig Walton at UNLV wrote a response to me in which he had George Bush debating Socrates taking the pro-abortion position. And one of the arguments he put in the mouth of Socrates was the argument that if abortion were to become illegal, only rich women would be able to get abortions. They would fly to countries where it would be legal. So when that came out, I knocked on Craig's door and I said, Craig, I said, I read your response to me and we're still very good friends. And I said, it's really good for our department that we sort of publicly can argue with each other and still be friends. And he said, yeah, I agree. And I said, but I do have a question about your argument. I said, and this is, of course, 1988. This is the height of the crack cocaine epidemic in the inner city. So I said, Craig, so you must be really excited about this crack cocaine thing. What? I said, yeah, because now poor people can indulge in the cocaine that only wealthy people have been able to indulge in for decades. Now we're able to spread the wealth. You know, it only costs $25 for just one little, you know. And he said, what? That's outrageous. And he said, that's a bad illustration because crack is bad. I go, oh, so the issue is whether abortion is bad, not whether it's equitably distributed. That is to say, the only time, the vice of the wealthy do not become virtues for the poor because the poor denied them. That is to say, the only way that a benefit or the only way something could be an injustice is if you're denied a benefit to which you're entitled. But if something is not a good, the fact that you're denied it doesn't mean you're being treated unjustly. You can't say, it's not fair, I can't pay for a hitman. It's not a good argument. The mere fact that something is denied the poor doesn't mean that it is in fact something they're entitled to. Now, there are things you can make good moral arguments for the distribution of certain goods to the poor and so forth, but they have to be goods. Bads don't count as goods. And now, of course, Craig's response is, well, I think abortion is a good. I said, okay, fine. Then that's your argument. Your argument isn't that somebody's denied it. Your argument is that it is a good. In order to establish it's a good, you have to show that the unborn is not a member of the human community, which means that that's the question. Right? We're back again to that question. So most of these arguments are like that. They always seem to beg the question or assume something to be the case, which has to be proven. Okay, let me talk about just two different sorts of arguments that you're going to hear in the academy. One argument is I call the state or government neutrality argument. Some of you may have heard of this argument before. And it goes something like this. The state or the government should remain neutral on questions of morality. And when the government, in fact, takes a position, if the government were to establish the pro-life position as law, it would violate that neutrality. So therefore, the current status of the law, namely that each individual person, namely each individual adult, can decide for themselves whether to have an abortion, that's the neutral point of view, and that is the one that's currently the law right now. So therefore, the current regime of Roe v. Wade is in fact morally correct because it turns out to be the neutral point of view. You may have heard this sort of, it's an argument where someone could say, I think abortion is wrong, but it should still be permitted. You know, some of the candidates for public office say this. I don't think anyone who's running for president would have the nerve to say this, but, you know, so many other issues, whether it's the environment or the question of whether how far a government should treat, let's say, prisoners of war, what constitutes torture, nobody argues that way. You never hear anybody say, I think torture should be safe, legal, and rare. You know? You never hear that. I mean, you never hear people arguing that way because they understand that it's wrong, and wrong things, the government can't be neutral on wrong things. Now, government can allow wrong things, but that doesn't make them rights. In other words, you can't have a right to do a wrong. There could all be all sorts of things the government could permit, but that's different from saying you have a right to it. And yet people will use this language on abortion. Now, what's wrong with the argument? Well, a couple of things. One, it really is not a neutral point of view. Let me give you an example of how I dealt with this in a discussion I had with a friend. Currently, the law says that the unborn are not persons under our Constitution. That is, right now, Roe v. Wade says that prior to birth, the unborn is not a person. Now, Roe v. Wade does allow restrictions, actually, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which is a 1992 opinion, which upheld Roe, allows for some restrictions, But no prohibition of abortion. The real first prohibition that was permitted by the Supreme Court was this past April in the Gonzales case, which actually upheld a federal statute prohibiting partial birth abortion. But prior to that, the Supreme Court allowed very few restrictions or limitations on the right to abortion. And the states, according to the court, have an interest in developing prenatal life, but that's not the same as saying that the unborn is in fact a person under the Constitution. In fact, it's only until birth that the courts say that the state can positively intervene and treat the newborn child, in this case, as a citizen with a full panoply of rights. So that's what the Constitution states. That is not a neutral point of view. It says that certain beings ought not to be accorded rights. I mean, imagine if we were to take this sort of argument and apply it to the issue of 19th century debate over slavery. And Stephen Douglas, by the way, in his debates with Abraham Lincoln, in fact, used this argument. He said, look, I'm anti-slavery, but I believe that the states should have sovereignty in determining whether they should allow slavery. So he was pro-choice when it came to slavery. That is, the states should be permitted to allow slavery. But of course, as Lincoln pointed out, that begs the question. What's the question? Who and what are we? That is, if the question is who and what is a member of the human community, you can't say the states, which consist of a community, can decide who and who is not part of that community. That is to say, you're already assuming that a class of individuals belong in that community, namely adults who can vote. And in this case, white adults that can vote. And so what the argument does is not offer a neutral point of view. It in fact offers a point of view. I mean, we can do that with virtually any position. Imagine if somebody were to say, look, I think the state should allow people to torture five-year-olds. Well, that's wrong. Wait a second. That's just wrong according to your point of view. Maybe there are some people out there who deeply believe that, consistent with their well-thought-out moral positions, that it's okay to torture their five-year-old child. Now, no one's forcing you to torture your five-year-old child, so stay away. You would clearly not understand that as a neutral point of view. You would say, no, it's saying that the state ought not to protect certain human beings at this level of development. Now, if, in fact, the abortion rights person wants to defend why these individuals ought not to be protected by the law, let them do it. But that's not a neutral point of view. It's a point of view. It's a point of view that says the human community only consists of beings after this certain level of development. That's not neutral. That's not neutral. In addition, the pro-life point of view, as well as the abortion rights point of view, answer precisely the same question. This is one of the mistakes that is often made in the public square, where the pro-life view is described as religious and therefore subjected to the First Amendment prohibition of establishing religion, whereas the pro-choice position is considered to be somehow neutral and secular. Actually, both views answer the same question, and the question is, who and what are we? The pro-life position is, we are in fact identical to our prenatal selves from the moment we come into existence. The pro-choice position says either we're not identical to our prenatal selves, or we acquire some characteristic later on by which we should attribute dignity and respect. But both answer the same question: Why should there be a metaphysical exclusionary rule that simply disallows the pro-life position from the outset? There shouldn't be. So at the end of the day, both points of view answer the same question. And there's no reason why the law could not reflect the pro-life view if pro-lifers, in fact, gained a majority and persuaded a majority of their fellow citizens to, in fact, agree with their position. What the pro-choicers want to do is actually to do just the opposite, to come up with a perspective that could never allow the pro-life position to be reflected in our laws, no matter how many people agree with it. By saying that it's not neutral, that their position is neutral, means that they always win by default. That's cheating. You have to actually offer an argument instead of just saying, well, since your position is religious and mine isn't, I get to win. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. You actually have to offer an argument. Okay, now let's move on finally to another sort of argument that you are going to hear. And this one is a little sophisticated. Many of you, if not most of you, if not all of you, know that the science is strongly in favor of the pro-life position. That is, there is very little doubt that, in fact, there's virtually no doubt that an individual life begins at conception. Now, there is a debate about between the first 14 days after conception, there's a time in which the embryo may be able to twin. And so there are some who argue, well, at the end of 14 days, it's an individual human being because it no longer has the intrinsic capacity to twin. I actually think that that argument doesn't work and deal with it in my book. But let's just set that aside because virtually no abortions occur prior to 14 days. And it would only really deal with the, it would really concern the issue of the morning after pill. Even that, I think, is deeply immoral. But nevertheless, most of the arguments that you'll hear that would defend abortion rights don't really deal with the first 14 days. What they deal with is the entire time of pregnancy. And the argument is that even though the fetus is a human being from at least from at most conception or at least 14 days, it is not a person until it reaches a certain level of development. Now, what is that difference between a human being and a person? The argument is that every person, every human being is not a person, and not every person is a human being. Now, we actually, as Christians and Catholics, we can agree with the second. Not every person is a human being, right? Angels are persons, they're not human beings, right? You know, and we know that at least two persons of the Trinity did not take on a human nature. So we know that God, in his being, is not by nature a human being. So we know that that there are persons that aren't human beings, but other human beings that aren't persons. Now, I'm going to read to you a quote here from a professor, David Boonin, at the University of Colorado Boulder, who published a book 6 years ago now called Defending Abortion, or Defense of Abortion, published by Cambridge University Press. In fact, much of my book is a response to Dr. Boonin's book, published also by Cambridge. And this is a quote at the beginning of his book, and I want you to listen to it carefully because it really gets to the heart of this point of view by using a concrete example of something in his own life. Dr. Boonin writes, "On the desk in my office where most of this book was written and revised, there are several pictures of my son Eli. In one, he is gleefully dancing on the sand along the Gulf of Mexico, the cool ocean breeze wreaking havoc with his wispy hair. In the top drawer of my desk, I keep another picture of Eli. The picture was taken September 7th, 1993, 24 weeks before he was born. So he's 16 weeks prenatal. The sonogram image is murky, but it reveals clearly enough a small head tilted back slightly and an arm raised up and bent, with the hand pointing back toward the face and the thumb extended toward the mouth. There is no doubt in my mind that this picture, too, shows the same little boy at a very early stage in his physical development. And there is no question that the position I defend in this book entails that it would have been morally permissible to end his life at this point." Unquote. That's the position he defends. He used his own son as an example. Very strange. In fact, one of my colleagues at Baylor, that's her nephew. And she's strongly pro-life, and it's actually, Dr. Boonin is her ex-brother-in-law. I'm not going to go there, but when I read this to her, she was, to say the least, very upset at that he would use this. What is his argument? Let's deal with his argument. Let me just say, before I deal with specifically Dr. Boonin's argument, I want to tell you what my understanding of the pro-life position is, and one that's the understanding, I believe, of the Church. And that is that human beings are more than a collection of parts. That is, we're a particular sort of being, or all organisms are what are called substances. That is, we are living organisms that have certain properties and powers that we have by nature that we can lose and gain, but we remain identical to ourselves over time. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Imagine you have a cat, a kitten, a domestic feline, Because it has a particular nature, it has the ultimate capacity to develop the ability to purr. It may die as a kitten and never develop the ability. Regardless, it is still a feline as long as it exists, because it possesses a particular nature, even if it never acquires certain functions that by nature it has the capacity to develop. In contrast, a frog is not said to lack anything if it cannot purr, for it is by nature not the sort of being that can have the ability to purr. So you don't say, for example, you come across a frog that's a perfectly healthy, normal frog, you don't say, poor frog, can't purr. In other words, it's lack of that ability. In fact, it's not really a lack. You don't say it lacks the ability to purr because it's not the sort of thing that can have it by nature. You don't say, like, oh, poor stone, it can't smile. No, it's just not the sort of thing that can do that. Okay, so we don't say, we don't feel bad for it. But yet, if a human being loses something, we feel, in fact, when let's say you read about, let's say, a car accident, where a championship athlete is cut down in the middle of a promising career, you say, oh, that's so sad. Now, we don't say he's less of a person as a consequence, but we understand that the loss of those abilities, because the capacity is cut short, is in fact a loss. But that loss doesn't change our judgment that it in fact is not the sort of thing that it is. It's still that sort of thing. It just lacks the ability to have those, it lacks the capacity to actualize those particular abilities. Okay, let me continue with the illustration. Second, the feline remains the same particular feline over time from the moment it comes into existence. Suppose you buy this feline and as a kitten and name him Chucky. When you first bring him home, you notice that he is tiny in comparison to his parents and lacks their mental and physical abilities. But over time, Chucky develops these abilities, learns a number of things his parents never learned, sheds his hair, has his claws removed, becomes 10 times larger than he was as a kitten, and undergoes significant development of his cellular structure, brain, etc. Yet this grown-up Chucky is identical to the kitten Chucky, even though he has gone through significant physical changes. Why? The reason is because living organisms or substances maintain identity through change. One of the problems today is that we have a kind of parts understanding of human beings. We don't think of human beings as organisms that gain and lose parts over time, but as, and this is, you see this in the way in which people look at the human body. In fact, if you read like the Theology of the Body by John Paul II, you see this kind of materialistic view which is dominant in our culture today. And so there is this tendency to think, if a human being lacks this or that part, therefore it's not a complete human being. But organisms intuitively aren't like that. We don't say, for example, that a 5-year-old is less of a human being than a 30-year-old. We do say that the 5-year-old lacks certain abilities because certain capacities have not come to fruition. But we still say it's the same being, or the same as the same essence or nature. Now, how does Dr. Boonen defend his point of view? Well, he argues, and this is an argument that you find among a number of philosophers, but it's, in fact, Peter Singer at Princeton is somebody that is well known for an argument similar to this. In fact, Singer goes as far as to say that that you don't even become a person until you're 18 months after birth. And that's why he defends infanticide. Very, very odd position. Now, Dr. Boonen, to his credit, doesn't agree with that point of view and says that what's important is that you have desires, and desires give you a right to life, and your brain reaches a point called organized cortical brain activity roughly between 25 and 32 weeks after conception, which is in the third trimester, and that's when you have a right to life, because that's when you can have desires, and desires are what determine whether you have a right to life. Now, if you think there's something wrong with this argument, you're right. There is. And I'm going to go over several problems with it. I don't have time to give you detailed responses. If you want to read a more detailed response, I have an article that was published 2 years ago in the Journal of Medicine and Philosophy. It's called Defending Abortion Philosophically, and it's a response to Boonen's entire book. It's a 40-page essay critiquing his book. And in there, I get into these in greater detail. But there are a couple of problems with this. One, there's what I call the counterintuitive problem. That is, we can come up with examples of cases where, in fact, people lose and gain abilities, and yet they are still persons. And let me give you the illustration, what I call the Uncle Jed illustration. Some of you may remember the Beverly Hillbillies, Uncle Jed. I'm not going to recite to you the lyrics, which I know. This is a story about a man named Jed, poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. Okay, my wife's telling me not to do it. Okay. Suppose your Uncle Jed is in a terrible car accident that results in his being in a coma from which he may or may not wake. Imagine that he remains in this state for roughly 2 years and then awakens. He seems to be the same Uncle Jed that you knew before he went into the coma, even though he's lost some weight, hair, and all his memories. Was he an intrinsically valuable human being during the coma? Could the physicians have killed Uncle Jed, the living organism referred to as Uncle Jed, during that time because he did not exhibit certain functions or have certain present capacities? If one holds, like Bunin, that intrinsic value depends on capacities, such as the ability to have desires that are immediately exercisable, it is difficult to know why it would be wrong to kill Uncle Jed while he was in the coma. Yet, it would seem to be wrong precisely because Uncle Jed is identical to himself through all the changes he undergoes, and that self, by nature, has certain basic capacities. Now, it can't be that Uncle Jed, this is different because Uncle Jed had a past and the fetus doesn't have a past. Well, the reality is Uncle Jed wouldn't have a past either, and here's why. If he loses all his abilities and his memories, when he comes out of the coma, he would be in precisely the same position as the typical fetus. He'd have to relearn everything from scratch. So the problem is, the first problem with Bunin's argument, I think, is that it runs into this sort of counterintuitive problem. That is, we can come up with counterexamples that show that we ordinarily would not kill such a being if, in fact, it was an adult in front of us. And yet, that adult in front of us is in precisely the same position as the typical fetus. Now, that means that what's doing the work for Bunin is size, level of development. And, of course, that's not relevant to whether a being is, in fact, a full-fledged member of the human community. In fact, if we were, let's say, Earth were discovered by aliens that were proportionally in size, let's say there was a size of, they were so big that we were like a zygote, we wouldn't all of a sudden become worthless as a consequence of that. In fact, there's an old episode of Twilight Zone like that, where a guy lands on a planet and there are these little tiny people and he destroys them, and then at the end he looks up and there's a big foot coming down on him. It's a great episode of Twilight Zone. So, in any event, so that's one problem. Another problem is the whole idea that desire is relevant to one having rights. And there's a couple of reasons why this fails. Patrick Lee, who's a professor at Franciscan University of Steubenville, gives a nice illustration. He says, imagine if somebody were indoctrinated from the moment they were infants to believe that they deserved to be a slave. And supposing they were happy in their state of being a slave, we would think that the person was wronged not because their desire for a right to life or their desire to be free was obstructed. We would think it was wrong because the desire for freedom was not permitted to come to fruition. That is, it wouldn't be they have a desire for freedom and you say, no, you're not going to have it. We would think the wrong occurred because their desire for freedom was not even allowed to come to maturity. But that's precisely the same thing that is done in abortion. Namely, the fetus is not allowed to come to maturity with all its capacities. Now, supposing, though, Bunin says, well, that doesn't work, Beckwith, because the fetus, or at least the child, already has organized cortical brain activity. Okay, I'll just change the example like I do in the book. Imagine if we were able to scientifically tinker with the cerebral cortex right before organized cortical brain activity arises in such a way that the trajectory of the fetus's development occurs in such a way that it actually never has a desire or never could have a desire for the right to life. we would think that the tinkering prior to the arising of organized cortical brain activity is in fact the wrong. But if you don't have any rights before organized cortical brain activity, there was no wrong. But that doesn't make any sense. Let me give you one more. It's called the brainless child example. We actually have there's a malady called anencephaly, which is the children born without higher brain functions. And we know how that happens. It happens because the neural tube in the development is blocked. The neural tube is sort of the primitive spinal cord, or what becomes the spinal cord. And it's blocked, and so the higher brain functions don't develop, and the child, when born, dies soon afterwards. There are some philosophers who have argued that such beings are not persons because they lack higher brain function. So, of course, it didn't take much time for some philosophers to suggest that we should create anencephalic children on purpose and use their organs. Carol Kahn, in an article in 1989 in the journal Free Inquiry, in fact makes that argument. And I use that in my book as a absolutely horrid example of what happens once you define personhood in terms of present function. Now, according to Boonin's account of personhood, what would be wrong in creating such beings? That is to say, we stop the neural tube from developing before organized cortical brain activity. Absolutely nothing would be wrong with it, according to his point of view. Now, I think from the traditional pro-life substance view of persons, we understand why it's wrong. It's wrong because human beings are entitled to the fruition and maturity of their capacities, minus disease or some tragedy. That's just part of the way in which we intuitively react when we hear about a being losing its capacities. Here, what's being suggested is that a being's capacities are eliminated on purpose for the good of another. That in itself, if that doesn't make you nauseous, I don't know what would. In fact, when I went to law school 11 years after I earned my PhD, I guess people in my profession, we don't buy Corvettes for midlife crisis. We go get another degree. And so I went to Washington University in St. Louis and took a course called Reproductive Control Seminar. I had already written a lot of stuff on abortion. I thought, well, this will be a fun class to take. And I was the only pro-life person in the class. There were 13 law students. And I did my paper on cloning. Everybody had to do a seminar paper and read the paper to the class. And one of the arguments I used against, or one of the reasons for cloning that had been offered in the literature, was to create brainless children. That is to say, you clone yourself, you create a brainless, identical twin of yourself, and you use those organs when you lose yours. This is actually suggested by people in the literature. And the students, all of whom were pro-abortion, just said, oh, that's terrible. And so I raised the question, why is it terrible? Well, it's just wrong. Why? Well, you're denying the child its capacities. Really? That's what abortion does, and you're for that. And they didn't know what to do. And I said, I actually told the classes, this is why this, unless we change our philosophy of the human person, this in fact will be accepted, because people will have to decide, something gross, or keeping abortion. Oh, I want to keep abortion, so I'm going to tolerate the gross thing. Whenever there's a cultural crisis, this is what happens. People either give up the bad principle, or they go with the bad principle, because they like the practice. And so at the end of the day, I mean, we have to make the argument. But let me open to the floor for any questions you may have. It's about 4:45, and I have about 15 minutes left. Yes, sir. Yeah.
He argues that granting the fetus as a status of a person, it would seem as if abortion would be morally permissible, and he gives the example in which somebody who's in a coma awakens, finds themselves.
Yes. Hooked to a violinist. Yes. Yeah, very good. I have a whole chapter on that in my book. Just didn't have time to go over it. It's one that you don't often hear. That's why I didn't mention it. But in the article, by the way, if you don't want to buy the book, half the article deals with that part of, because most of Boonin's book, actually 60% of it, is just dealing with that argument. The argument was originally developed by a philosopher named Judith Jarvis Thompson at MIT. And she says, imagine, this is actually 1971 she wrote this, imagine you're at a Society of Music Lovers party and you find yourself unconscious, hooked up, you wake up and you're hooked up to a world-class violinist, and you're the only person in the world who has the right kidney, and so the violinist has to use your kidney for 9 months. Don't worry, the violinist has a right to life, and you can't unhook yourself as a consequence. Now, of course, you can see the analogy. The attempt is to say that somehow abortion or a pregnancy is like that. Now, there are a couple of reasons why I don't think it's like that. One is, first off, we have to ask the question, is there a connection between sexuality and pregnancy? Boonin and I had a formal debate. I delivered a paper at the American Philosophical Association critiquing his revision of Thompson's argument. He was my commentator. And so one of the guys in the audience, a philosophy PhD student from Berkeley, said to Professor Boonin, are you suggesting that if there was a machine here, that every time I touched it, it would give me a kind of, let's say, every time I hit this button, I would get this sort of quick endorphin pleasure, and I knew that a human being would come into existence as a result of it, that I would not be obligated to care for that human being. I could just simply keep on hitting it and pop him out just because it brings me pleasure? He had no answer. Because, and even that's not, I don't think that's the best illustration of pregnancy. The point of the questioner was that there's a much more intimate connection between between pregnancy and sexual intercourse. In fact, one could argue that, and I argue for this in the book that and in the article, that the intelligible point of sex is in fact pregnancy. That is to say, that is its good. That is the consequence. Does that mean it always results in it? No. Does that mean that every time someone acts that they intend it? No. But it does mean that there's a much greater intimate connection between the two. Secondly, the fetus's natural resting place is in fact the womb. So I think you can make the argument that in fact, unlike the violinist who was artificially hooked up to the person who attended the party, that in fact the fetus naturally belongs there. That's where it in fact is supposed to be. And so I think the burden then shifts to the person who says that it ought not to be there. Secondly, or thirdly, there's the problem of what I call the deadbeat dad example. That is, once the child is born, the state can rightfully conscript the father's bodily labor for 18 years to make sure that child, supposing that the father fixes cars, he's a mechanic, the state can say 20% of your physical labor to take caring automobiles must go to caring for this child. Now, supposing he said, wait a second, I didn't intend for her to get pregnant. I wore a condom. She took birth control. So clearly I didn't intend it. Why should I be forced to take care of the child? And of course, you know, Boonin bites the bullet here. He actually says the deadbeat dads who did not intend to get the woman pregnant, in fact, are not obligated. Now, to his credit, at least he bites the bullet. But what he's also saying then is that there is no natural caretaker for children. To me, it seems that there's a deeper intuition that, in fact, parents ought to care for children than that I have bodily rights to do whatever I want. The second intuition is only one that a independent, middle-aged baby boomer could love, but not somebody who has actually reflected on the history of mankind. That is to say, there is something bizarre about somebody who says, it seems as though my bodily rights are more true than what parents are obligated to do to care for children. So it's another word. That's, I mean, that's sort of a rough way of responding to him. I mean, one of the things he does do is he comes up with a counterexample. In fact, let me see if I can read that quickly. So I do want to be fair to him. He says, imagine this. He says, you are the violinist doctor. 7 years ago, you discovered that the violinist had contracted a rare disease that was on the verge of killing him. The only way to save his life that was available to you was to give him a drug that cures the disease but has one unfortunate side effect. 5 to 10 years after ingestion, it often causes the kidney ailment described in Thompson's story. Knowing that you alone would have the appropriate blood type to save the violinist were his kidneys to fail, you prescribed the drug and cured the disease. The violinist has now been struck by the kidney ailment. If you do not allow the use of your kidneys for 9 months, he will die. So he says, well, if you give him the drug, does that mean he's entitled to your kidney? See, I think that's a bad comparison, because by giving him the drug, you're actually putting the violinist in a better position than if you didn't give him the drug. Whereas when you bring a child into existence, killing the child, he's worse off than he was before. So it's actually not... So the illustration doesn't work. In other words, this is one counterexample I use. Imagine if bringing a child in... Let's supposing somebody gives you a fertility drug and the person says... the child that you will bring into existence will have a heart defect. And supposing you bring the child into existence and you willingly do not try to remedy the heart defect, supposing it's really simple and inexpensive to fix, and the child dies, I think you are in fact committed a wrong, because you intentionally brought into existence a vulnerable child with a defect you knew would be. And you didn't do anything about it because he's worse off than he otherwise would have been. So I think that the illustration doesn't work. But it's a complicated argument, and it's kind of funny. I mean, I go back and forth. I have this one illustration where I say, imagine if you give somebody, imagine there's a doctor, a female doctor, who her patient is her husband. She's pregnant with the husband's child. She gives him a drug. He winds up having an allergic reaction, and yet she's also carrying a cloned version. It's just this whole weird example, and I show that she put all three persons in a position of vulnerability, and she has an obligation to all three. And so it wouldn't matter whether it's which one. So. And now, of course, there's the one other comeback to this that it's not even clear. My wife is like, no, one more. And this has actually convinced one of my friends who's pro-choice, so I'll share this with you. I use an example of a woman who's, let's say, isolated in the middle of nowhere, who opens the door. She gets a knock on the door, and a helicopter flies away, and at her door is a newborn infant. And she has no way to contact anyone to take care of this child. And what does the good person do? She could leave the child there and let the wolves eat it, or she can bring it into her home and take care of it and wait, let's say, several months for someone to come back. Suppose there's a note in there that says, I'm coming back in 7 months for this child, please take care of it. What would we think of the person if they said, I didn't consent to this, I'm going to let it die? Now, we would say, please stay in that isolated part of the country and do not join my community, and just read your books on moral philosophy. There's a sense in which there's this intuition that rises up when we think about vulnerable persons put in a position for which others can care. And I think that's why it's different. So, okay, my wife's going, okay. One more question, and I think we're, I, yes, ma'am. You'd have to ask everyone that. I just, I don't know. I mean, I do. Well, there should be. You know, look. If I had, I will. Yeah, the Catholic Church has taken a pretty strong position. In fact, very strong position. Now, are you suggesting that maybe there should be more homilies on it and so forth? You know, I'm not. You're going to hear much argument from me. on that. But, you know, every parish is different, every diocese is different, and that's all I can say. I'm not going to... I just came back to the Catholic Church 8 months ago. I don't want to start... I don't want to start trying to criticize that, but... But I do think that I would like to see more adult education. I mean, it doesn't have to necessarily be in the Mass. I spoke a couple of months ago at Holy Spirit Catholic Church in Atlanta. It has a wonderful catechesis for adults. It's not RCIA. It's just kind of like Sunday school. And I spoke there, and I had a wonderful turnout. So I think a lot of that may be a way to go as well, to get people informed. I've got about a minute left. Any other questions before? Yes. Yeah, so two ways. There's two ways to deal with it. One way is to simply say, well, birth control and abortion are two different issues. Now, you could say, as a Catholic, I think birth control is immoral for a variety of reasons, they're not the same reasons why I think abortion is wrong. Abortion, I think, is unjustified homicide. And there, the state or the government can, in fact, play a role. Now, if the argument is, well, if there was more birth control, there'd be fewer abortions, that's an empirical question, and I'm not sure that's correct, and here's why. We were told, actually, right around the time of Roe v. Wade, that in fact, with abortion being legal and birth control being everywhere, that we would have fewer abortions. You know what happened? We had more abortions. And the reason was this, is that abortion was thought to be sort of the fallback position. And it was assumed that if birth control didn't work or contraception didn't work, a woman would get an abortion. But they didn't predict was this, the number of women who said, I'm very uneasy about having an abortion. And so this is why from the mid-70s onward, we have a growth of single mothers. Because they underestimated, ironically, the moral objections that people had to abortion. But I do think we have to make a case, and this is something I think, you know, you have to make the arguments that you can make given the culture we live in. And the culture we live in right now is not in a position to hear a sort of anti-contraception argument. However, I do think you can make the argument that there is a deep connection between what one thinks about the human body and its purposes and how one comes out on the issue of abortion. I've done a lot of speaking at evangelical churches, and I will tell you, it's interesting, the evangelical movement, which had been largely pro-contraception, is shifting precisely because of this reason. I speak every summer at Summit Ministries, which is mostly evangelical students. A few Catholic students go to it. And I am amazed the number of evangelicals who are anti-contraception, largely because they're starting to see the deeper connection. So, yes? That's right. Yeah, the pill is, in fact, can function as an abortifacient if, in fact, it's got a three-prong effect to it. But thank you so much. I enjoyed my time here, and God bless you. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by FOCUS, the Fellowship of Catholic University Students. If you would like to listen to more talks, please visit us at www.focusequip.org.